This is Car Expert.
Subaru didn't really need to mess too much with the Forester because it's actually the brand's best-selling car in Australia.
If you're buying a ute to actually be a ute, then the GWM's the go. If you're buying it to be a refined kind of towing-friendly SUV with a tub, maybe the Musso's the one for you.
I think it's going to be a real shake-up for the whole market and realistically the overall market of four-wheel drivers.
Hello, I'm Mandy Turner, and hello, Mike Costello.
G'day, Mandy.
And hello, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
You've been living in an EV world recently, Scully. The XC40 Recharge and the Ioniq, which we've both spoken about in the past on the podcast, but it's always cool to get other people's opinions on them. So how was your time behind the wheel?
Yeah, I've been driving them both for a comparison, which should be live, actually, as this podcast goes live. I really enjoy both of them. Every time I drive an electric car, I'm reminded that they're just really, really nice things to drive and they're smooth and quiet. But they're also very different. The Volvo feels very conventional. It's like an XC40 inside. It looks like an XC40. And the way it drives is obviously electric, but there's far less going on to shout at you that this is the future. And then you hop in that Ioniq with its like lounge-like interior and its crazy seats and its interesting dashboard and flat floor. And the thing just shouts at you all the time about the fact it's electric in the future. So it was really interesting to put them back to back.
That's what I love about this comparison. And it was why I was so keen for it to happen, because I think this twin test is really emblematic of what's happening in the world of electric cars. You've got two fundamentally different approaches. The ground up electric car on a skateboard platform with all the technology that screamed its intentions, and the one that's just a modified version of a familiar car that is way less sort of scary and requires way less sort of change in mindset. It's emblematic of a wider thing, and I don't know what the better option is, and I'm looking forward to finding out your view on that, Scully, but yeah, it's certainly an interesting kind of comparison in that sense.
It's definitely one of those ones, and Moco, let me know what you do think of the words which I sent to you not all that long ago. It's a bit of live behind the scenes on the podcast. but they're both priced within about $1,000 of each other. They have very similar range claims. They both do 0 to 100 in around 5 seconds. So on paper, they are pretty much identical. And if they were hot hatches, for example, you'd say they'd be really hard to split before driving them. But having driven them both back to back and just looking at them, they couldn't be more different in the way they're put together. So I won't spoil the result of the comparison, but yeah, two very different ways to achieve a similar outcome.
Interesting. Maybe we might have to go into a little bit more detail on an actual proper podcast chat soon. You've also been driving the Outlander, and it'd be sort of interesting to have a bit of a chat about this as well, because Moco, you've driven it too.
Yeah, new gen Outlander, and you know, the comparison with the old one is a bit like broccoli to chocolate, isn't it? You know, the new one is quite a good looking. I mean, a lot of people don't like the nose of the new one, but I think it looks awesome in the flesh. Ours was in a particularly fetching shade of red. And it looks bold and interesting in a way that the old one, despite having, you know, 9 or 10 running updates, never really managed to do. Hugely practical inside. The screens are so much better than before, especially the instruments, really crisp and sharp. But, you know, there's been a few, I guess, criticisms of its sort of lackluster petrol engine. Of course, a plug-in hybrid comes next year. And the dynamics, which are okay, but certainly not class-leading.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get into the car news, shall we?
Yup.
Scully, it's the battle of the Hyundai and Kia SUV concepts. We've had a couple revealed this week, and my oh my, do they catch the eye?
They sure do. These two Korean brands obviously work together as part of the same automotive group, and they're building on the same base, but they've taken very different approaches to doing big, boxy electric SUVs. The one that I think looks better is the Hyundai 7. I know Mike disagrees with that, and I'm sure he'll tell us why shortly. But it's meant to be the next step in the Hyundai range after the Ioniq 5. And we think the Ioniq 6 is going to be the prophecy concept that was revealed a little while ago. It has a 3,200mm wheelbase, so a longer wheelbase than the Palisade. It's got a 7-seat interior that can be converted into an autonomous driving lounge. And it's got up to 480 kilometers on a test cycle that Hyundai hasn't specified. So it's really meant to be the biggest, boldest, most luxurious family SUV that Hyundai can do on its new eGMP platform. although each of these Ioniq cars looks a little bit different, you can still tell that they're all related because they've all got those really cool, funky, they call them parametric pixel LED headlights and taillights. But this is a big, upright, boxy car, and it looks very different to the angular, kind of retro-futuristic Ioniq 5. There's a couple of really cool features in this concept, and, I mean, whether they'll make production or not isn't guaranteed. I'd be very surprised if when this car launches, likely in 2024, it has a mini fridge and a shoe preparation station in it. But the concept has both of those things, so you can arrive at a meeting well-lubricated and with shiny shoes. Jumping across to the Kia, it's a very similar size to the Hyundai. It's built on the eGMP platform, but it's got a slightly shorter, 100 millimeter shorter wheelbase. And it's also got a style that is a little bit more aggressive than the Hyundai. It's got this really upright front that looks like the Mojave SUV they currently sell in Korea. And then the rear end is sort of transformer-ish with really sharp angles and LED taillights that run down the back of the boot lid. Kia says that it's meant to look highly capable, practical, and ready for action. Like all the other cars on the eGMP platform, it's got 350 kilowatt charging, which means that this concept that, again, we expect will come to production in a form that looks a lot like what we see here can be charged to 80% from 10% in just 20 or 30 minutes plugged into a DC public fast charger. Obviously, these cars are just designed to be studies or to show where the design is going, but both of them show the freedom that designers have using this eGMP platform, and I kind of can't wait to see what the production cars actually look like. I'm also really curious, Moko, why do you like the Kia more?
Oh, look, styling's subjective, isn't it? But, I mean, in this case, you're obviously wrong. The design is just great. I mean, I, again, you talk about concept features that aren't going to make production. Well, this has got rear opening, you know, suicide style doors with no pillars. So you've got that, you know, awesome, completely empty side profile, which is really, you know, enhanced, I guess, by that super flat floor. But, you know, design is just one part of the picture. I think the bigger picture here for me is the real losers in this are going to be every brand that makes a big 7 or 8 seat SUV from 2025 onwards, quite frankly, because, you know, the number one thing for anybody buying an SUV this big is space and practicality. And the skateboard platform gives you so much more of that. There's no transmission tunnel. There's no humps and bumps and lumps. It's just a really open, spacious vibe, which is why they're pushing that point so hard. And you can easily imagine just how bloody dated things like a Kluger or even a Palisade are going to feel in just a few years' time once these things are actually in showrooms.
Well, every one of our reviews of those cars, even the best of them, like the Kluger and the Palisade, always say that, yes, there's decent space, but the boot floor is high because you've got to get the seats above rear motors or in the Kluger or rear drive shafts and differentials and that sort of thing in the all-wheel drive Palisade. You know, the interior space is limited because the floor has to be a certain height, which means you can't be too tall sitting in the back. So it's going to be really exciting to see what clever way these cars are packaged and how they move the game forward.
I'm looking forward to it as well. We've had a Lexus plug-in hybrid confirmed for Australia, Moko. Which one is this one?
Yeah, so not just Lexus's first plug-in hybrid, but also based on its most important car, the all-new NX medium SUV. The outgoing NX, of course, being its top-selling model in Australia. This new one shares a lot with the Toyota RAV4 Prime, which isn't sold here in Australia because Toyota thinks it's too expensive. Of course, that's less of an issue for Lexus. Now, this is interesting for a few reasons. One, there are a ton of premium plug-in hybrid medium-sized SUVs already on sale, the XC60 Recharge, the X3 from BMW, the GLC from Mercedes-Benz has one as well. So clearly there's a market there for it. But also Lexus has been the normal hybrid leader for such a long time. And it's been a bit incongruous that these other brands have been, you know, skating past it on the electrification front because it was there first. So from a branding perspective, it's really important. I think the company's done a really good job with this new X. It's not just a reskin like the IS was. This is a new vehicle. It retains a hint of the old car's styling, but is much more resolved and smoother. I think Lexus has finally figured out what it wants to do stylistically. The rear and the front actually look like they belong to the same car now, you know, like they're really figuring it out. The really impressive part of this car, though, is that it's not just a FEV. It looks like a hell of a FEV. So the 2.5-litre petrol with motors at each end powered by an 18.1 kilowatt-hour capacity lithium-ion battery, which gives you a system output of 227 kilowatts, which is north of 300 horsepower. 0 to 100 matches a Golf GTI at 6.3 seconds. And you've got a claimed electric-only driving range, which, of course, none of its current hybrids can do, of 87 Ks. Now, the caveat to that is that's on the NEDC cycle, which is not particularly realistic. So something more like 65 or 70 Ks would be what I'd be expecting. But in terms of performance and efficiency and range, it's ahead of basically every other plug-in hybrid on the market, especially in its segment. Which for a Lexus is obviously a huge fillip. The wider vehicle itself is a huge step up, particularly in terms of its interior interfaces and materials. Dynamically, Lexus says this car's a big step forward too, though we'll obviously have to wait until we drive it for that. But I think there were people that might have been moving away from Lexus if it didn't get its act together and modernize like the Germans. And I think this is a great example of how, you know, the brand can really redefine itself in Australia.
It's going to be exciting to see in person what the new interior is like, because the current NX is comfy, quiet, you know, refined, all the Lexus things we really love, but it just feels old. It's got the touchpad. It doesn't ride as well as it probably should. So, I mean, plug-in hybrid aside, and I think it's a really cool addition to the range, the FEV, but like most FEV offerings, I reckon it'll be pretty low volume. Beyond that, there's all sorts of opportunities for this new NX to really move the game forward for Lexus and finally give the X3 and the GLC and the Q5 a bit more to worry about, because on paper it looks fantastic.
And let's not forget, this shares its bones with the new Toyota RAV4, which, you know, conventionally it really hurt the old NX because the old RAV4 dynamically was pretty crap, but the new one's pretty good. And so it's not a bad set of bones for it to share. And there's no reason why this car's not going to drive 100 times better than the old NX. So I can already say that all of those familiar criticisms that we have that Scully just alluded to will be ironed out on this new car. Either way, we'll get to drive it in January of next year when the launch happens, so we can update you then.
Good stuff. Now, the next story, Scully, this had me really intrigued. Were we going to get a V8 Ute here?
We were very close. So we all know that Holden is no longer selling cars in Australia, and we all know that the Colorado is now dead. But there was a point there where it wasn't, and we spent some time last week with Wall Control Performance, which is the sort of big umbrella. The Wall Control Group is the big umbrella brand that does a lot of converting of American pickups to right-hand drive for Chevrolet and for Ram. It also makes performance parts for these cars, and then it's got a towing group as well. But back in the day, it was essentially HSV. And what they wheeled out for us, along with a whole lot of their new stuff that we've also covered at the website, was a Holden Colorado sports cat, but with a 6.2-litre Chevrolet LT1 V8 engine up front instead of the old diesel engine. And I tell you what, it looks a lot better than the Colorado did when it had a diesel engine. This car was a prototype, but it was a prototype that Walkinshaw says had gone through two of the three steps that were really required to get it to production. The business case had been made, the engineering had been signed off, and they were now at the stage of trying to work out how to actually manufacture it at the Rayong plant in Thailand that General Motors used. It's got 193 kilowatts and 117 newton meters more than the normal Colorado, so 340 kilowatts and 617 newton meters. And it had all sorts of new stuff in there, new front and rear prop shafts, a new four-wheel drive transfer case and a 10-speed auto, and then a whole lot of bespoke software to make it all talk as well. The car pictured in our story has some really cool details on it. It's still got the Camaro rocker cover on the engine. It's got the last real HSV on the VIN plate. And the best part of it all is that had it made production, Walkinshaw tells us it would have cost around $80,000, which,
what?
As we know now, is Ranger Raptor money. Wow. Whether or not that's what it actually would have hit showrooms at when Holden or HSV realized that people really wanted this car remains to be seen, but based on what we've been told, that's what they were targeting.
Do you know what the most frustrating thing about this car is? This is just the latest chapter in an endless book of Australian ingenuity being miles ahead of the United States but getting none of the credit. Because what is the darling vehicle in the United States right now? It's the Ram TRX. Journos are falling all over themselves. The V8 Wrangler falling all over themselves. This is amazing. This is a game changer. a bunch of dudes in a Melbourne warehouse made this car like a few years ago to exacting OEM standards, and it was so ahead of the curve, and it was only killed because the entire Holden brand got killed off, you know, pretty much an existential threat to the program. But it's so frustrating that once again this brilliant Australian project has been kiboshed by bigger forces than what, you know, than bigger forces than really Australia can handle.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Moco. In our story about the Aussie Colorado, we also mentioned, and we actually got to drive the American Chevrolet Colorado, which is a sort of half size bigger than our Colorado with the same engine in it. It was a left-hand drive prototype, and just, I know that prototypes aren't meant to work like production cars, but it drove like a production car, except it had a Camaro steering wheel, and to change the drive mode, they had to open the bonnet, pull some wires and press some buttons and then close it again, and it all work. Walkinshaw was doing that because in the future, the plan was for the American Colorado and the Aussie Colorado to come together into the one development pool, but also because at the moment in the States, it's got a 3.6 litre V6 or a 2.8 litre turbo diesel engine with similar outputs to the Aussie Colorado. It'd be the same VM Motori engine, but there was a chance that that car would have got the V8, and Walkinshaw was doing some development on that vehicle. Having driven it down the back straight at Sandown and through an off-road course, it is a crying shame that thing never got built for the US, let alone Australia, because it sounds like a V8 supercar. It's got side pipes and it absolutely slaps through the gear changes. And then we did a little off-roading course with a Ram 1500, a Chevrolet Silverado 1500, and this Colorado. And it just absolutely walked through. It's a great size. It's got incredible suspension travel with those really fancy Multimatic dampers that are on the ZR2. It really is a perfect rival for the Ranger Raptor and even the bigger F-150 Raptor. And the idea of a V8 that was developed in Australia, being sold in Australia, or even being sold in America would have been an awesome story. But, yeah, like Mike said, it's another story that is only told as a what-if rather than a well done.
Guys, I think the thing that really grabs me here is if this Colorado V8 actually got off the ground and made showrooms, how many Ranger Raptors do you think Ford would have sold in Australia with that 2-litre diesel? I'm thinking about zero. You know, as good as that Ranger Raptor is, and I love that car, the person who's buying that car would take a V8 every single day of the week. Even yeah. Mad Ford fans would have considered switching to the General, I reckon.
Yeah.
It's incredible to think that the sports cat, which we kind of laughed at the time because it took the Colorado and made it essentially in line with what we expected of the non-modified rivals that Holden had. Imagine if the sports cat had the V8. It would just be a totally different story. And, I mean, I have no idea what would have happened to HSV and to Holden. GM is much bigger than just this product, but it definitely would have put a different spin on the brand's final days in Australia.
Yeah, such a sad story. Now, lastly, Moco, we've got another hybrid that could be coming for Australia, the Jolyon.
Yeah, talk about brands that are on a roll. Great Wall Motor, or in this case, Haval, which is one of Great Wall Motor's 5 or 6 sub-brands. I lose count. Now, GWM Australia and Haval Australia, the same company, are now the number one export market for that Chinese brand in the world. So that means that when the company in China is making new products, Australia is going to increasingly become a priority. We know that regular hybrids in the SUV space are really starting to get uptake. They're a lot cheaper than EVs, but fuel prices, if you haven't looked outside lately, are at record highs. So it's quite obvious that hybrid SUVs are going to sell. The H6 hybrid is already coming. We already know that. The smaller Jolyon, which is going to be a rival to the CHR hybrid from Toyota, the Subaru XV, the Kia Niro, the Mazda MX-30, this growing pool of mild hybrid small SUVs is pretty much a shoe-in. You know, middle of 2022, it's going to make it here. I don't think it's been officially confirmed yet, but it's a fait accompli that it will happen. And that Jolyon, Scully, you've spent more time in it than I have, but it's a pretty good thing as it stands. And when you consider that it's going to probably have 140 kilowatt and 375 newton meter hybrid system with a dual clutch auto and 4.2 liters every 100K fuel economy, which is about half what the non-hybrid gets, it should stack up as a pretty damn good thing. In fact, it might be the best Chinese made car that we've seen to date.
It absolutely could be. That Jolyon, it's got a couple of sort of quirks or foibles that Haval needs to eventually work out of it. But as a base for the hybrid, it's really, really impressive. And if you look at those numbers, 140 kilowatts and 375 newton meters would make it the punchiest little hybrid SUV on the market, because the CHR even the RAV4 all-wheel drive and the Subaru XV are pretty light on for power. So I can absolutely see a spot for it in Australia. I am a little bit disappointed, though, that Havel didn't give it the full 179 kilowatt, 530 newton meter version of that same powertrain from the H6, because that would have been a proper tire frying little SUV hybrid.
I reckon it would tear those Gitti Severos off the front wheels in about 8 seconds flat. Actually, no, I think it has Goodyear tires on it. Looking at it, they've actually invested in good rubber. But I reckon that 179 kilowatt Havel H6 hybrid is going to be torque steer central. I don't know how they're going to tame all that power going just to the front wheels, but we'll wait and see. But yeah, look, Haval is my smoky, by the way. GWM Haval, they're the same company, even at the different brands. GWM Australia is my smoky to make the top 10 next year. MG has made it this year, much to everybody's surprise, as the sort of first Chinese brand to do it. And I reckon GWM, looking at their product rollout, especially over the first half of next year, will be knocking on that door. I reckon the likes of Nissan and Honda will be terrified of what that brand has coming up.
I think it also probably bears mention that although the Jolyon we're going to get in Australia will be made in China, this Jolyon hybrid, where it was revealed in Thailand, is actually built in the same plant that the Colorado V8 would have been built in. General Motors sold it to Great Wall Motors, which now uses it to build the H6 and the Jolyon for the Thai and Southeast Asian market, which is a bit of a crazy look at where the market has gone.
Isn't it interesting that there was no intention of those two stories having anything linking them, and had this really important factor linking them? Hey, there you go.
That's amazing. That's it for this week's news. Head to carexpert.com.au and click the news link for more. Scully, I like what you wrote on the heading for one of your recent reviews. Subaru has tweaked its strong-selling Forester SUV for 2022 with a new look and extra technology. Has it messed with a winning formula? You had me absolutely hooked. Now, I know this is probably a question that you would answer at the end of the review or even with a podcast chat, but can we start off with that question? Has it messed with it?
We can start off with that question, and the answer is no, it hasn't. Subaru, right, for a really long time, has represented sort of solid, safe, all-wheel drive motoring, and the Forester is that still. Very little has changed for 2022, but there are a few tweaks to it.
Okay, so what are those tweaks?
So the main one you'll notice is that it's got a slightly different front end on the outside. Subaru's just tweaked the headlights to look a little bit more angular and aggressive. A lot of it's stuff under the skin. There's a redesigned instrument panel that looks very similar to the last instrument panel. Gesture control for the air conditioning. And then there's bits and pieces like the front coil springs and dampers have been retuned, and there's new engine mounts. Very little has changed, and you really feel that from behind the wheel. But Subaru didn't really need to mess too much with the Forester, because it's actually the brand's best-selling car in Australia. And it's outsold the Hyundai Tucson and Kia Sportage so far this year. I know both those cars are in run-out, but neither is what you'd call slow selling. So there is always a risk that if you fiddle with the formula, you fiddle with it too much. And it's easy to understand why Subaru's kept things pretty simple here.
Very true. What's the new price?
So the car we tested was the top-of-the-range petrol model, which is the 2.5-litre IS. It's priced from $44,190 before on-road costs, which is equivalent to about $49,000 drive away, according to the Subaru website. It's actually pretty well priced when you consider what it goes up against. It puts you up against a mid-range, sort of mid to high-range Outlander, the Aspire, which is actually the one we've been driving recently, which is priced at $43,990, or a Hyundai Tucson Elite N-Line with the 1.6-litre engine, which is about $45,000 before on-road costs. So the Subaru comes with everything you could want. There are no options at the top end of the range, and it is pretty sharply priced. You can pay more for a Forester, and that's for the hybrid. It's $3,000 more expensive, but you absolutely should not do that.
Oh, wow. Why is that?
We've reviewed the hybrid before on Car Expert. Paul's done a video of it as well, and it's the mildest hybrid you could possibly find without actually calling it a mild hybrid. And compared to a Toyota RAV4 for the same price, it really doesn't stack up. So The Forester is a good thing and it's got lots of strengths, but that hybrid isn't one of them.
Fair enough. Yeah,
the point you made, Scully, about not wanting to make too many changes, I think kind of hits the nail on the head, because the Forester has something that most of the other medium SUVs doesn't, which it has a sort of boxy utilitarian appeal to it that most of the others, as they've become more refined and luxurious and tech-oriented, have lost. It's certainly pretty capable off-road. It's clearly not a Jeep Wrangler, but its all-wheel drive system is good. I love the massive windows that Foresters have, the thin pillars that they have, the fact that there are buttons everywhere. It's a very simple but kind of friendly yet rugged vehicle, and it has a kind of charm all of its own. And so I really think that Subaru's done the right thing here by, you know, making some subtle changes, a very Japanese update in that sense, just tweaking the formula very, very slightly, but sort of keeping what the car stands for. It's pretty clever.
It is interesting. We expect a certain character of Subarus, and I say that having I've owned four cars and three of them were Subarus, so I have a little bit of experience with the brand. And the Forester still hits on a lot of what it is we expect from the brand. You sit in any Subaru, and they all have the same steering wheel with a million buttons on it that are a little overwhelming at first, but you get used to really quickly. They've all got the same infotainment system. You start them up and they all make the same, even though it's much more muted than it used to be, the same slightly wobbly boxer noise. So there are a lot of people who have only owned Subarus or have owned three or four in a row who just go from car to car within the brand. And it is interesting. I think there are some areas where this Forester would really benefit from ripping it up and starting again. And we'll get to that when we talk about the driving. But for the people who like what Subaru stands for and what it does, anything more than the changes that have been made here would probably be a bit overwhelming. So, yeah, it is easy to understand why they've gone that way.
I suppose it's a great family car. So is there enough safety features to keep the family safe?
There are lots and lots of safety features. So Subaru has had its EyeSight system for quite a while now. It's a stereo camera mounted behind the mirror on the windscreen. And it gives you autonomous emergency braking, lane keeping assist, active steering in on the highway, which is another addition for 2022, and all of the other stuff you would expect of a high-end mid-size SUV in 2022. It's also got a facial recognition camera, which actually sits above the dashboard and looks at your face. And when you get in the car, it's able to read who you are and adjust the settings to your liking. It's also able to beep at you if it thinks you're tired or you're not concentrating on the road.
Wow.
If you're someone who gets tempted by your phone behind the wheel, it's a really good idea because the beep is really annoying. My problem with that camera is it also beeps when I like tilt my head a little bit to the left or adjust my seating position a little bit because I'm on a long drive, and it goes, stop getting distracted. And I'm not getting distracted. I'm just moving my head. So I ended up turning it off when I got in the car, but I can see the benefits of it. Especially if you are a family, and these are family cars, and you've got maybe a husband and a wife, or you know, partners driving the car, plus kids, being able to get in the car and have the seat move to your spot, the radio move to your preferences, without having to fiddle with buttons or mess around with different keys, is a really handy feature. While we're talking about the family friendliness, I know we've talked a bit about the Honda CR-V on the podcast recently. The Forester is very similar to it in that it's got rear doors that open really nice and wide. It's got those tall windows and a boxy profile. And it means that if you are loading kids in and out of the back seats or you want to carry tall teenagers around, it's one of the best mid-sized SUVs out there. Say what you will about the way it looks. I personally quite like it, but I know some of our readers don't. That boxy profile just means that you can sit in the back if you're tall and there's still space for your head. It also means that, you know, the doors are nice and upright, they open nice and wide, and there's lots of storage space. But also when you shut the door, you're not going to get a big funky door trim cutting into your child's seat or banging you on the elbow. It also means that short kids or people sitting in the back aren't going to get car sick because there's enough light in there and they can actually see out. So a lot of the really boring practical stuff that we often forget about and get distracted, you know, from when we look at a really sexy new design has been thought about here. And that has always been one of the benefits of the Forester.
I'm sick of all this praise. We've got to get a little bit negative. So let's talk about what isn't good about the Forester. Now, I didn't drive the update, Scully, but I know that I was never a huge fan of the engine. I know in the con section of the review it says engine is never anything more than adequate. It's a bit of a shame because old Foresters used to have great turbo options that had tons of character. The company has really sort of shrunk its engine lineup. Guessing not much has changed on that front. That naturally aspirated engine is still kind of bland and not much chop.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think part of Subaru's problem, and we talk about how beneficial its history is to it, but part of its problem is also that its history is full of these really exciting turbocharged Foresters and WRXs and cars that looked practical but were actually like rally cars to drive. The new Forester is not that. got a 2.5-litre naturally aspirated boxer petrol engine. And 136 kilowatts and 239 newton meters sound like pretty normal outputs for the class. But in practice, the car just never feels anything more than fine to drive. Put your foot down, and even if you're not trying to go very hard, the CVT sort of flares the revs a little bit and it makes a bit of noise. And if you put your foot down harder, if you're going up a hill with a load on board or you just want to get somewhere quickly, it can get really noisy and droney and do all those things that we don't like about CVT transmission cars. It's not far off being good. I mean, there are similar cars in this segment that have similar outputs that actually feel adequate, but just the way that the engine is tuned, it sort of feels a bit gutless and lackluster like older naturally aspirated boxer engines. But it also, it doesn't have the character that they did or the sort of wobbly, offbeat feeling that they did. It's got, yeah, none of the character, but also a fair few of the drawbacks that afflicted those engines. The other thing you'll notice about it is that it's not overwhelmingly efficient. On the highway, we saw decent numbers, but around the city, it was averaging around the 8 litre per 100 kilometre mark. And although that's decent for a big car, you can get similar numbers out of a 2.5-litre turbocharged Mazda CX-5 or a 1.6-litre turbo Hyundai Tucson or Kia Sportage if you're not driving in a hurry. And those cars all offer way more mid-range push, and they also have proper either torque converter or dual-clutch transmissions. So, yeah, performance is something that we'd love to see improve. Subaru offers turbocharged engines overseas, but not on the Forester in Australia, and if we had to submit a wish list come December 25 to Subaru, that engine would be at the top of it because it would really improve the Forester.
Mm. How about those servicing costs?
So Subaru's been criticised for servicing costs a little bit in the past. It sticks with strangely specific pricing. For the non-hybrid, a three-year service plan is going to cost you $1,269.15. And a five-year plan is going to cost you $2,413.63. That's more expensive than you'll pay for a RAV4 and much more expensive than you'll pay for a CR-V. It's also not beyond the bounds of what's reasonable, though. So as long as you know what you're getting in for to start with, it's okay, but there are cheaper cars to service out there.
All right, that review is live at Car Expert. It's great to welcome back to the Car Expert podcast our off-road editor, Simon Christie. Hello, Simon.
G'day, everybody. Great to be back again.
Yeah, absolutely. You recently had a ride in, as you say in your review, maybe the most anticipated 4x4 of the decade, the Ineos Grenadier. I know this was only a ride and it was the prototype, but we're still keen to hear your experience with it. Before you go into a bit more detail about that, can you give us a catch-up on what exactly the Ineos Grenadier is?
Yeah, well, it's a four-wheel drive, but it's I'm talking about anticipation. The marketing team have done a great job of leaking out information or deliberately passing on information, keeping people up to date with what's happening and really highlighting the fact of what's going into it, who's designing it, how it's been designed, what the target market is, and each element, especially the important elements of the off-roading that are going into the design, the makeup, and now the build of the vehicle. And we're seeing prototypes around the world. So what the core thing about the Ineos Grenadier is, it's a vehicle aimed at the off-road enthusiast. And they've done a really good job of trying to make it a vehicle for everybody. It's not going to suit everybody's needs, but for a cross-sectional vehicle that covers as much of a base as possible, they've really hit the nail on the head. So they've gone back to some old school types of things, solid axle at the front, really good capable four-wheel drive system. But whether you're a farmer or an off-road enthusiast or a four-wheel drive tourer, or you need a wagon for work, this thing is going to cover it all and do it well in a package that really sort of comes out of the early mid-90s, but has all the modern accompaniments and features of the 2020s of a modern vehicle. So it's a great package overall.
Mm. It's interesting how that squarish body design is coming back in. What was it like seeing it in person as opposed to photos?
There's been so much media around this vehicle. There's been so much leaked media, deliberately shown media, that it's what we all expected. It's touching and feeling and seeing it and seeing those finer points that you can't pick up in a photo or a video that really make the difference for somebody like myself. But it's really hard to say. I'm 50-50 whether it's a mistake that it has that strong heritage to the Land Rover, the Defender, etc. where people are going to associate it with that type of utilitarian vehicle, or whether they're coming off that really powerful history and moving forward from that in a modern way. So the look overall of it, the boxy shape of it, it definitely appeals to a certain type of market, but it definitely comes with a lot more flash and class to it than the old utilitarian vehicle. So seeing it firsthand allowed us to really get a good eyes-on view of the closer, finer details that make this vehicle a real step apart from what the old Land Rover really is.
Simon, you know better than us, but off-road people and people who rely on their vehicles for work can be quite hard to convert from one brand to another. Do you think INEOS has done enough in both the design of the Grenadier and having now seen a prototype up close in how well it's put together to convince people that they're going to be able to move on from their Land Cruiser 70 or their old Defender and into a Grenadier?
Again, it comes down to that 50-50 in half of that argument. The 50-50 is the mindset of the Toyota Land Cruiser against the Land Rover, you know, vehicle, etc., and drawing them away. The reality is that they're coming off a vehicle, they've said, yep, we've got some heritage, but we're moving ahead with that. And the end result is what the Land Cruiser owners really want. What do Nissan Patrol owners really want? If they want a live front axle, if they want a vehicle that's built for purpose, if they want a vehicle that's going to be comfortable and modern and tough enough to do the job, this thing is seriously going to turn heads. And I'm talking cranking the necks, bang, of Toyota owners. The diehards have got no excuse but to take a look at it and take it seriously. So I think it's going to be a real shake-up for the whole market, for the diehard Toyotas, Nissan Patrols, etc., and realistically the overall market of four-wheel drivers. And it's one thing to mention Land Cruisers, but really the big bulk of the market are dual-cab ute owners. And dual-cab ute owners have had a gutful of being told what a modern four-wheel driver wants. And they really want that performance, they really want that toughness, which is the solid front axle, the four coils, the disc brakes, a good package, and that's what INEOS have delivered.
Yeah, and on that note, Simon, there's a couple of other things that I reckon they've really nailed as far as the enthusiast vote is concerned. One is the interior, which is just nothing but buttons and switches, not just on the center fascia, but on the roof, a bit like you see when you're getting onto a plane and you check out the cockpit. It's got room for all of those add-ons that 4x4ers love and the accessories. And on that front, INEOS also has what it calls an open source approach to accessories. So it's giving its CAD and its technical drawings and even vehicles to the aftermarket ahead of the launch so that, you know, the likes of ARB and Iron Man can develop their kit for it on the, you know, proviso that that kit will be available in INEOS showrooms. So rather than treating the aftermarket in a kind of adversarial way, they're actually embracing it. Do you think that's going to be a real fillip for the brand to try and convert some of the diehards as well?
Well, you've raised some really good points. Now, going back again to the older type of vehicles, even Land Cruisers, Patrols, we've all come from that farm ute mentality where it's all utilitarian. Now, there's nothing inside that dash of the INEOS, which is flash, beautiful leather, wood grain and modern design, but they've taken that utilitarian design and they've actually made it 1,000 times more functional by including switches, access to dials and options that allow you to upgrade and include, and they've made it far more of a functional cabin space. Then talking about that cabin space, you've got Recaro seats from factory. Like they've taken one of the big things that people would dream about doing with their vehicles, which is installing quality aftermarket seats, and they've got those in there from standard. So that interior is really set up for the enthusiast, but the enthusiast, again, we're seeing it's functional, it's utilitarian, but it's going to really make people feel comfortable and take them into the 21st century, no issue at all. And then, as you mentioned, the way that they've integrated their design process to allow aftermarket accessories, and they're doing that in a complementary fashion. So they're going to offer some of their own factory accessories, bull bar, for example, but they still want ARB, TJM, Opposite Lock, et cetera, other providers to be able to provide aftermarket accessories. So the end enthusiast is really being encouraged to individualize their INEOS from the very beginning, but it's coming to market with a backup of aftermarket accessories ready to go. And that's a really important and a very new thing.
I know you weren't in the driver's seat, but I'm completely intrigued. What sort of terrain did they put you on and how did the Grenadier go getting up or down or around it?
Look, they're obviously very smart with what they do, and they've picked a beautiful scenic winery as a location. you've got that cafe latte sipping mentality, but you're out near Hanging Rock, on a little bit of a picnic. Yet they threw this thing around the paddocks and they didn't tiptoe around. They really got stuck into it. There was some good ups, some good downs, some good mud, some rocks, plenty of bouncy stuff and some really good off-camber stuff. And in a very subtle but proactive and positive manner, they really pushed the boundary. So I can imagine some of the journalists would have felt quite uncomfortable. And then other journalists like myself would have been, hey, wow, that suspension is really working a treat under these conditions. They've really picked not only the terrain, but the speed they're throwing us into it to really highlight certain aspects of the functionality of the vehicle. And they did a good job. So we had a really good mixture of terrain. It wasn't just a belt around the paddocks. It really was some seriously well-picked obstacles for us to cover. And it was good. It was a great drive, very impressive.
I've got to say, on a slightly personal side, I was in the car with you, Simon, and as the audience is now learning, and I didn't pick up even half as much off-road thoughts as you did. I'm not a specialist off-roader to anywhere near the same degree you are, but I was quite amazed by what you were actually able to pull out of that short drive. I got a few observations, but it was I would consider it a brief, maybe 15-minute stint. But you came out of it furnished with really concrete ideas of how the car goes, which was pretty amazing to me. I sure as hell didn't come out of it with that.
Look, it's horses for courses, and if I jumped into a modern sporty electric vehicle, I'm sure that I'd get far less out of that than you would, Mike. So horses for courses, but
maybe. Yeah,
look, that's my area of expertise, and I had certain targeted things that I wanted to look at, I wanted to hear, I wanted to feel, I wanted to see. And I did get to see those, so of course I'm going to pull out things that are far more catered towards my enthusiast market than what the average automotive journalist would have seen for sure.
Simon, what engine powers it, and do you think it is suited well to it?
I don't know. No. Again, it's the whole top secret Ineos thing. They wouldn't let us have a look under the bonnet. You've got that straight six BMW engine, which is available in the diesel or petrol. And they're actually still doing something. This is the difference between being a passenger and being able to drive it. I really couldn't get a feel for how the engine was working, how it was applying the torque, the power, et cetera, and what parts of the pedal feel applied that power. But it drove well, it handled well, it did everything that I needed to do from a passenger point of view. And I really won't be able to comment on that engine until we get more facts, more specs, more information. They did, though, let it slip that they will be fine-tuning that motor, tickling the ECU for better off-road performance. So it'll be very interesting to see what they do. And that's one of the questions about the car. You pulled an engine out of a BMW road-going vehicle. It's all torque and power, but is it applied at the right rev range? Is it applied at the right sort of RPM for off-roading? So if they can tweak that and tune it, they're going to be onto a seriously good package. And again, they're living off that BMW name where you're coming from something that is already proven, it's well-established, it's a known brand. And it just creates more of an eye-opener, an eyebrow raiser about the reliability, the functionality of this vehicle. So I think they're doing well with the engine. It's not over the top. It's definitely not underpowered. But we'll see what happens when they finally do the final tune on it.
So Simon, we know the starting price is going to be $84,500 before on-road costs, another $1,000 or so for the extra rear seat bench, which puts it just above the 70 series five-door, which is as old as the hills by comparison, but a hell of a lot cheaper than a, you know, G-Wagon or anything along those lines. Even after you put some extra stuff in it, and even if you are nudging 100K, do you reckon that's the sort of price band that enthusiasts will be interested in paying?
We've already seen a long history with the Land Cruisers, the Patrols, the people who are up there and willing to spend that. We're now seeing people in that dual cab market with the Rugged X pushing it, and certainly the Ranger Raptor up in that high price point. And it's not far beyond those price points where we're seeing this vehicle sitting at its entry-level price. I think it's really well priced. I think it's really going to turn heads. And apart from the performance, the ability, and what this vehicle stands for, that price point is really going to put it front and center in people's view when they're looking at a new four-wheel drive that can do what they want it to do.
Can't wait to see this car on our roads. That prototype ride review is at carexpert.com.au. Thank you so much for your time, Simon Christie.
You're welcome anytime. Thank you.
It's the battle of the affordable utes, the SsangYong Musso and the GWM Ute. Moko, great idea to put these two head-to-head.
Yeah, look, we're seeing these two are really tearing up the sales charts at the moment. Dual cab utes are about 20% of the market overall, but I don't know if you've seen the price of a Hilux or Ranger lately, and not just a new one, but a used one. I mean, if you've only got 40 grand to spend, you're looking at a five-year-old 150,000K on the clock Ranger. So, you know, why not consider the Musso from Korea or the JWM from China? They both have seven-year warranties. They both, on paper, offer pretty much everything that the others do, a little bit less power and torque, but unless you're really hammering it, plenty. And so we wanted to ask that question of, you know, if you've only got 40 grand and you want to get yourself a half-decent dual cab, do either of these stack up?
So we probably should talk about some specs. What engines are underneath the bonnets?
Yeah, so these two, in terms of the engines, they both fall just short of the class leaders. The GWM has a 2-litre turbo diesel four-cylinder, 120 kilowatts of power and 400 newton metres of torque. The saving grace is that it has an 8-speed automatic transmission from ZF, so it has a lot of ratios to play with to make sure it stays in the sweet spot. It's also got an on-demand all-wheel drive system for the road, but it also has low range on top of that, which is quite a sophisticated system where most utes are part-time 4x4s with low range, which is the case for the SsangYong Musso. But the Musso does have the better engine, a 2.2 litre in-house turbo diesel with 133 kilowatts and 420 newton metres, 6-speed automatic only, but a 3.5-tonne towing capacity and a more conventional part-time 4x4 system with low range. And the real thing that you notice when you drive that Musso is you wonder how the hell has such a tiny minnow of a brand that's perpetually on the brink of bankruptcy made such a good engine? It's not only punchy, but it's super refined. It is the quietest pickup truck in its segment. And you have to go up into one of those big full-size American trucks to get a more refined dual cab ute. It's remarkable how solid the engine is. So on the powertrain front, you're definitely giving the SsangYong the early lead.
Oh, how refined is the interior for both?
So the interiors are what have really impressed people. I've heard from so many people that have climbed into either of these and bought one that, oh my God, the cabin is nicer than a Ranger's. And in actual fact, it kind of is true. So the GWM has a brilliant screen. It's got a really big touch screen with the most sort of high-end, sophisticated 360-degree camera in the class. It's got, you know, really nice leather seats. It's got all the bells and whistles that you could want. I mean, both of these vehicles are just over 40 grand, are the absolute top spec models in their range. And then the Musso on top of that adds things like Nappa leather seats and ventilated seats and a sunroof. Like, these are essentially luxury utes priced below a mine spec stripped out base Triton GLX, let alone a SR5 Hilux or something like that that's miles more expensive. So, you know, if the brief is to sort of feel a bit like a premium SUV with a tub on the back, they both actually do it pretty well. Up front, the Musso is definitely the more tactile. Where the GWM wins is in the rear. The back seats are huge. I'm 6'4", not quite as tall as Scully, but still a fairly lofty chap. And I had acres of room back there, as well as, you know, rear vents and really easy to access ISOFIX points for child seats. So for those who are carrying kids, the GWM is definitely the go. The GWM also just nailed a 5-star ANCAP crash rating, which is really, really good for that car and reassuring for its buyers, whereas the Musso is untested. So the Musso, a bit more luxurious, but as a second family vehicle, I'd be saying the GWM gets the nod.
So, Moko, having been lucky enough to drive both these utes, my overriding memory is that the Musso, with its engine at least, is just like a giant SUV with a tray on the back. How did you find the two of them side by side? Because the GWM, in my memory, didn't quite stack up to the same level.
Well, it depends on what you mean by level. And I think in a sense, you're right. The Musso does feel more SUV-like. It's punchier. It's a bit quieter. It's a bit cushier inside. It's got coil springs at the rear that are more road-oriented. But if you're buying a ute to actually do ute stuff, that's kind of where the GWM probably takes the edge, especially in the payload department, which is north of a ton. So the GWM's engine is probably its letdown, as I said, although GWM did do a running software change recently to make that throttle response and calibration a little bit better than it was. It's not quite as doughy, so that's a good thing. There are good signs, like the stability control tune works really well on gravel. It doesn't kill all of the torque, which shows a degree of effort went into it. It's rolling on Cooper tires. It's got disc brakes all around. So there's definitely mechanical upsides to it. If there's one thing that JWM could really benefit from, it would be a local tune. And the reason I say that is Australia's roads are quite distinctive. There's a massive variety of surfaces, and it's quite hard to get a vehicle that feels as good on Aussie roads as a Ford Ranger does, and that's precisely because the Ranger was developed right here in Australia. The good news is JWM is actually now in the process of tendering a local tuning program, so that should really sort things out. Even if you drive other cheap utes like the LDV T60 with its Walkinshaw suspension tune, it makes a world of difference. So that's the real downside to that car. I put 650 kilos in the back of it, and it's sat relatively stable. The performance, actually, the ride got a little bit more tied down and comfortable, which showed that as a fit-for-purpose ute, this thing's pretty good. Just a little bit of room for improvement. Off-roading, again, the on-demand all-wheel drive system doesn't seem much chop, but in actual fact, it worked really well. Just a loggy hill, some, you know, offset cambers and moguls and things like that. Some fairly deep ruts to really test the rear diff lock. It all worked relatively well. Not amazing, but did the job. The Musso, as I sort of said before, is definitely the NVH winner. It's ridiculously refined. Its ride, especially at the rear when unladen, doesn't really feel a heck of a lot more settled, despite the fact that it has that more car-like configuration at the rear. It doesn't have quite the payload, and it doesn't feel quite as good with that load in the rear. So it sort of is a horses for courses thing, I suppose. If you're buying a ute to actually be a ute, then the JWM's the go. If you're buying it to be a refined kind of towing-friendly SUV with a tub, maybe the Musso's the one for you.
Moko, it's probably also worth mentioning a couple of the features these utes have that the Ranger and the Hilux can't actually match. It's pretty incredible that the Musso has a sunroof, has heated and ventilated seats, has all this stuff that we associate with luxury cars, but is in a $40,000 or $45,000 ute.
Yeah, and then you look at the JWM and you've got stuff like a spray-in tub liner, you've got gas struts on the tailgate, you've got a little step ladder that pulls out of the tailgate, you've got quilted leather seats in that too. So both vehicles, as you say, are bringing features to the table that you just can't get on the competitors, and not even the top spec ones, just any of them. I mean, the only other ute with a sunroof is the Navara. So in terms of spec, I mean, that's where these sort of value brands have always played. They don't have the badge cred that the others do. So they have to offer long warranties. They have to offer parts and suppliers that are quite reputable. And they have to offer a metric ton of features for the money to kind of lure people over the line. And in both cases, that's exactly what you're seeing here.
Well, speaking about over the line, which one did come over the line better?
Well, I got some feedback from people saying, you know, the words that you wrote sounded like you preferred the Musso, but you gave the win to the JWM. And fair enough, I can see how people would say that. In some ways, the Musso is the better bet. I gave the win to the JWM in the end because it's a better ute. Like, it's actually better at carrying stuff. Its back seats are better for carrying big, burly blokes. There's a little bit more configurability in the works as far as the aftermarket is concerned. So I thought, you know, for the average ute buyer, the JWM stacks up better. I think the saving grace both these cars have are their long warranties. With a seven-year warranty, you're more likely to take the punt and take the plunge and go for a cheap ute like this. Against a used $40,000 Hilux, I can totally see why people would. And now that JWM has the 5-star crash rating as well, that's the sort of final tick in the box of reassurance. So, yeah, that for me is the one that takes the edge.
Yep. Well, head to the site if you want to read the full comparison that Moko has written. All right, that's an end for this week's podcast. What events and launches are coming up next week, Scully?
It's a really big week. Tony's driving the Porsche 911 GT3 in Sydney, which makes me immensely jealous because I can't
He'll
wait.
He'll really hate that.
He will. And he'll tell us how slow he is around a track and how humble he is as well, and we'll put up with it and it's fine. Nissan Navara Warrior. Mike, you're going to be traveling to drive that car, which has been pushed back a few times because of COVID. So very curious to hear what you think. But the big one is the Ford Ranger reveal. There's going to be a digital reveal, and then on November 24, there's an in-person reveal in Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane simultaneously. And I believe at 6:15 on November 24, all of our coverage of that car should also go live on the website. Cannot wait to have a look at the new Ranger, because even though it's all under embargo, we haven't actually seen it yet, but we've just heard so many rumors and so many bits of background information and that sort of thing. So hurry up and reveal it, Ford.
And you know how the market has changed, because there's also the official local reveal next week of the new Honda Civic, Scully. And once upon a time, a new Honda Civic would have been headline news. But of course, today, dual cab utes are all the rage and they're the cars that matter. So it's the Ranger that we're excited about.
Mm, unreal. So what cars have we got coming up next week, Moko?
Really good spread, actually. We've got the new Lexus UX 300e, which is Lexus's first electric vehicle. We've got a Suzuki Jimny Lite, the cut price base version of that incredibly popular Jimny. I actually own a Jimny, as is quite well known, so I'm really excited to see this one. The new generation Mitsubishi Outlander in flagship Exceed Tourer guise, a BMW 330i. We've also got a Range Rover Evoque Diesel are dynamic. And then up in Sydney, Crawf is driving the new Volkswagen Caddy, which shares its platform with the new Golf. And we've also got Kurt driving a Lexus RX 350. So we have got a big spread of vehicles across the company. And, gee, it's going to be a busy week.
It certainly sounds like it. Mike Costello and Scott Colley, thank you as always.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, guys.